President of the United States to say, hey, Russia, or hey, Ukraine, or hey, China, I want your help in my election.
My priest! Nobody move! Get over there! Okay.
We are situated by the Senate offices. With new evidence piling up, Republicans are working tirelessly to ignore all of it.
Can I get up with it?
Trump's claim that he can do whatever he wants is very much at the core of Trumpism and the modern Republican Party. And that ethos is very much on display in this impeachment trial. Republicans have spent a decade pretending to be a principled party based on limited government and respect for the Constitution, when in reality, they never cared about any of that stuff. Today's Republican Party is an authoritarian movement led by people who believe they should have the power to impose their will on everyone else. And Trump perfectly embodies that authoritarian mindset, which was on display in its clearest and most obvious form yesterday when Trump lawyer Alan Dershowitz made a truly shocking argument that it doesn't matter if Trump engaged in an illegal quid pro quo to cheat in the 2020 election, because if he was doing something to help himself get reelected, that means he was also doing it in the national interest.
Every public official that I know believes that his election is in the public interest. And mostly you're right. Your election is in the public interest. And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
That is an absolutely insane argument that is antithetical to literally everything the founders believed when they wrote the Constitution. Think about what he's saying there. He's saying that if you believe you being president is what's best for the country, then you're allowed to do whatever you want in order to remain president. That's insane. By that logic, Trump could shut down airports under the pretense of high winds anytime one of his Democratic challengers had a flight. One of the president's lawyers literally just said that he can commit an illegal quid pro quo to cheat in an election, and that's fine. But as you'll recall, when the allegations first emerged, Trump and his supporters insisted adamantly over and over and over again that no such quid pro quo had ever occurred.
There's no quid pro quo, no demand, no pressure, no threat.
There's no quid pro quo.
There was no quid pro quo.
There is no quid pro quo.
There is no quid pro quo.
There was no quid pro quo.
There was no quid pro quo.
There was no quid pro quo.
But listen to this. There is no pro quo.
That's right. There was no pro quo, I guess. We can't expect the president of the United States to remember that many one-syllable words.
The American people are disgusted by the Washington Democrat wish, and you say it.
Quid pro quo doesn't matter. It's a red herring. It doesn't matter if there was a quid pro quo or not.
And you offer someone something of value and then literally in the next breath say, I would like you to do us a favor, though, as Trump did on his phone call with the president of Ukraine. That is the literal definition of a quid pro quo.
The Senate voted against calling witnesses in the impeachment trial 51-49. Ever since that vote, Republicans have been coming up with lame excuses, like Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. Senator Murkowski announced on Friday she would be voting against any witnesses, explaining, I have come to the conclusion that there will be no fair trial in the Senate. I don't believe the continuation of this process will change anything. It is sad for me to admit that, as an institution, the Congress has failed. No, it hasn't. Senate Republicans have failed.
He shouldn't have done it. And I said he shouldn't have done it. And now I think it's up to the American people to say, okay, good economy, lower taxes, conservative judges, behavior that I might not like, call to Ukraine, weigh that against Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and pick a president.
Okay, but rigging the way we pick the president is what Trump's being impeached for. This is like saying, yes, he cheated at poker, but how dare you accuse him of cheating at poker? He will now prove he is innocent by cheating you at poker.
What the president should have done was, if he was upset about Joe Biden and his son and what they were doing in Ukraine, he should have called the attorney general and told him that and let the attorney general handle it the way they always handle cases that involve public figures.
And why do you think he didn't do that?
Maybe he didn't know to do it.
Look on the bright side. No. Look on the bright side, Chuck. Maybe the guy with the nuclear launch codes is a complete idiot.
Political science teaches us that in the context of a democracy, authoritarians, all other things being equal, should be expected to get reelected, because authoritarians should be expected to use the powers of the state right. to get reelected. And that general principle has loomed for me over the leadership of President Trump throughout his first term in office, because that's what I have been expecting about how he would try to secure a second term in office. I did not expect that Trump's lawyers would lay down a legal framework to try to pre-clear him for any such actions.
I think the impeachment trial itself is a joke, period.
It's a show.
We think it's a complete sham. He hasn't done anything wrong.
How did we get here with no evidence?
He didn't do anything.
He didn't do anything.
Very
well said.
Well, that's it, right? He didn't do anything.
He didn't do anything.
So we should let everybody testify.
Correct. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
Do you think John Bolton should testify?
No.
Why not?
Well, he could testify, but I think he's vengeful for getting fired from his job. I think he's a liar.
John Bolton's a liar.
Absolutely.
There should be a system set up where he takes an oath and then under oath he tells the truth. Otherwise, he's punished.
I think there should be, yes.
And maybe there's a judge who's put in charge, like the highest judge in the land.
Right.
Appointed by a Republican. And then we could all see what he has to say. Would you be for a system like that?
Sure.
I've read the transcript not verbatim, meaning like I've watched everybody read it on the news. I haven't seen the transcript.
You know that's not what reading the transcript means. But you watch people read the transcript.
Right. I haven't personally read the transcript. Have you read the transcript? No.
I have. Spoiler alert. He asked a foreign country to interfere in our election. It's crazy, right? It's crazy.
There's no, whatever that word is, quid pro quo.
There's no crime that's been, there's no crime that he's been accused of.
What does that mean?
What?
What do you mean?
They've not making an accusation or brought an actual penal code.
You can tell he hasn't done anything wrong just by his demeanor. I mean, he would be trying to hide things.
If he were blocking witnesses or evidence or something like that, you'd be like, oh, you're hiding something. But
right.
Otherwise.
Right. He's saying, let him see everything.
Let him see everything.
I'll prove whatever you want me to prove.
Right. But Trump is blocking witnesses.
I don't care.
Oh. But we were saying earlier that if you're blocking something, it shows that you have something to hide.
They're going to impeach him again.
Is there going to be another impeachment?
I probably all the way for 5 more years.
Did you feel the impeachment was a distraction?
Not at all. I don't think he's got skin that is about as thick as it gets.
Donald Trump is?
Yeah, thick skin. He's
thick skin. He gets mad if a celebrity makes fun of him on Twitter.
Well, it's good. I like his tweetings.
He should take a victory lap. It should have already happened. He can do whatever he wants.
Let's say it happens tomorrow. Trump
right.
beats impeachment. Trump can get on to running the country.
Exactly, like he has been doing for the past 3.5 years now.
I mean, and now with like no impediments, no checks, no balances.
Exactly. They need to have like more restrictions on who can just come up with articles for impeachment when nothing's been done.
Who's in Donald Trump's way going forward?
The only people that would be in his way are other Republicans trying to get in office.
Yeah, he's evolved this presidency into a dictatorship that we could all understand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
The only real drama today was whether any Republicans would dare vote against Donald Trump. And it turns out there was one man with binders full of courage.
The president asked a foreign government to investigate his political rival. The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust. With my vote, I will tell my children and their children that I did my duty to the best of my ability, believing that my country expected it of me.
The vote on obstruction of Congress was 53-47, pure partisan split. Hmm. But on the first charge, on abuse of power, the vote was 52-48. And on this dark day, there was someone I would like to thank for giving me a ray of hope. Utah Senator Mitt Romney.
The grave question the Constitution tasks senators to answer is whether the president committed an act so extreme and egregious that it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Yes, he did. Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine.
To which Trump replied, "Wow, you don't have much of an imagination, do you, Mitt?"
The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust.
Yes, that's what the impeachment managers were saying the whole time. Someone was actually listening to the substitute teacher, Mr. Schiff. You got through to the tall, quiet kid who has trouble making friends. In the back of the room. Nothing means anything. Right is wrong, up is down, Missouri is Kansas. Now we know that asking a foreign power to interfere in our election is the new normal. The Democrats have no choice but to do the same thing.
Russia, if you're listening, I could really use that pee-pee tape, milk, milk, lemonade. Around the corner, justice is made.
Now, Senate Republicans claim they're not setting the precedent that presidents are above the law because Trump is going to change.
I think that he knows now that if he is trying to do certain things, whether it's ferreting out corruption there in Afghanistan, whatever it is, he needs to go through the proper channels.
If a call like that gets you an impeachment, I would think you would think twice before he did it again.
I think he'll be instructed by what has occurred here.
Oh, he'll be instructed by what occurred here because nothing occurred here. You know, there's a saying about those who fail to learn from history. I don't know what it is because I failed history. The only lesson Trump ever learns is that he gets away with everything. Multiple bankruptcies, nothing. Multiple sexual assault accusations, nothing. He's in perfect health despite eating like a rat behind the Bob's Big Boy. Nothing. The senator who has most successfully talked herself into believing that she believes in something is Maine Republican Susan Collins, who last night said this.
He was impeached, and there has been criticism by both Republican and Democratic senators of his call. I believe that he will be much more cautious in the future.
In the future, he'll be more cautious and not get caught. She now says she probably shouldn't have said she believes Trump has learned his lesson from the fallout from his dealings with Ukraine and impeachment. She now says a better word would have been hopes.
Wishing and hoping, yes, wishing and hoping, and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming.
Now, other than Romney, another Republican senator who was considered on the fence was also about Trump was Susan Collins of Maine, right? But she decided that we don't need to throw Trump out because she thinks he's already been scared straight.
I'm voting to acquit. I believe that the president has learned from this case.
What do you believe the president has learned?
The president has been impeached. That's a pretty big lesson.
However, during a TV anchor's lunch at the White House yesterday, Trump responded to questions about Collins' comments, saying he had done nothing wrong, and that his conversation with Ukraine's president, quote, was a perfect call.
Your Honor, my client has learned his lesson. No, I haven't. His days of selling drugs are over. Who wants cocaine? Because clearly Trump hasn't learned a lesson. If anything, he's learned that he can do whatever he wants and Republicans will let him get away with it.
Does anyone seriously believe that I would consent to these consequences other than from an inescapable conviction that my oath before God demanded it of me? As a senator juror, I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the Constitution demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience.
Hearing Mitt Romney take his oath to God seriously was like finding water in the desert. Because we know Republicans are lying when they say that Trump didn't do anything wrong or that maybe he did, but he shouldn't be removed. Every person who leaves the White House and writes a book about it, or every journalist who gets to peek behind the curtain, they all tell us the Republicans privately are horrified by Donald Trump and want something, someone, to do something to stop him. But they don't have the balls to say that out loud when it matters. That's why an oath is important. Now, oaths may not mean a lot to some people, but here's what it's about. When you take an oath, you can't think one thing and say another. You are asking God to witness on the pain of your immortal soul that what you whisper in your heart is what comes out of your mouth. Though most of these guys are talking out their Now, in Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons, the main character, Thomas More, is the lone voice opposing Henry VIII, a bloated, golden child who none dared gainsay, who destroyed anyone who did not follow him blindly, and then went ahead and destroyed a lot of people who followed him blindly anyway. And in the play, Moore says this to his daughter, Meg. He says, when a man takes an oath, he's holding his own self in his own hands like water. And if he opens his fingers then, he needn't hope to find himself again. Well, with the lone exception of Mitt Romney, I think the Republicans have just opened their fingers. They will be missed. So please join me in thanking Mitt Romney for being honest, for not lying to us or to himself, for serving the Constitution rather than that monstrous child in the White House. Why can't he be president? Thanks, Obama.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Focus. Focus. It was Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart who said, "In my eyes and ears, the organ is the king of instruments." The glorious sound of the mighty pipe organ, with its thousands upon thousands of individually speaking pipes. No greater glory has been known on God's earth than its majesty. It brings beautiful music to the multitudes, and greater glory to God. What is the story of this magnificent instrument? How did the organ come to reign over the musical world? Early man knew only the music of his own voice, accompanied by a rhythm produced with sticks and stones. In biblical times, the voice of man was often accompanied by pipes. The Romans combined many pipes together into the water-powered hydraulis, which excited the populace of public spectacles. The organs of the Middle Ages were primitive. These early organs had very few stops and required only one bellows boy. Whereas the larger instruments of the 16th century required many men to supply the organs with its hunger for ever more air. The pipe organ was shunned by the early church, which forbade the use of organs in services, for it was understood to be a worldly contrivance, which aroused earthly passions and was already long associated with ungovernable festivals and mayhem. And yet, today, the pipe organ stands proudly at the very center of man's religious and civic life. The music of the pipe organ marks the most important occasions of our lives. But what can account for the mighty organ's awesome power and capacity to enthrall and inspire? Behind its stately architectural presence and dazzling ornaments are a host of ingenious mechanisms requiring the sacrifice of animals. Sheep for the bellows, elephants for ivory, horses for glue. It demands the ongoing toil of men to work its bellows, maintain its workings, and, of course, it requires a dedicated organist. Through time, the organ has placed ever-increasing demands upon the organist, stacking several manuals to occupy his hands, sprouting pedals for his feet, and presenting a bewildering array of controls for the use of all four limbs. While behind the console, the wind chests strain to dam a reservoir of pressurized air. Soldierly ranks of pipes, some 10 times higher than a man, stand ready to speak. The music of the organ is projected up long vertical pipes so that music may be sent heavenward. Once good and evil were polarized by the ejection of the devil from the kingdom of heaven, a powerfully charged field was created through the plane of the living. As the glory of music rises from earth, the force between good and evil draws melody through any existing musical conveyance. It is in our nature and right that we worship God and sing His glories. But as the number of inanimate musical conduits increases, the flow of glory is directed away from human beings and diverted through these musical culverts. We stand now at a critical point, edging toward a fall from which we cannot recover. The majesty of the pipe organ has confused and misdirected parishioners who attend services in the mistaken notion that they go to worship God, when, in fact, they go to worship the organ. After all, it can instill fear in the hearts of the strong and the weak, the righteous and the sinner. And large modern organs are increasing in number every day. The deleterious effects are most noticeable in those who work closely with these instruments. Just as the glass harmonica player is driven slowly insane by its tones and poisoned with lead crystal, the hatter slowly loses his sight and his sanity to mercury vapor. And the nuclear worker inevitably succumbs to the deadly half-life of radioactive waste. In the popular imagination, organists are perceived as lunatics, creeps, ghouls, and demon outsiders, exiled from the musical community and isolated in cramped and cornered conditions. It is not that the organ attracts these kinds of individuals. Rather, it is what the organ does to them. Perhaps this is why 9 out of 10 organists, church musicians as well as secular, are homosexuals. Homosexuals, who of course are well known for their artistic temperament and love of soft cushions. In fact, the effects of the field surrounding the organ are so profound that most organists harbor the notion that it was not Jesus of Nazareth, but Johann Sebastian Bach, who was the Son of God. Organists, as a matter of routine, are forced to go without sleep, nourishment, fresh air, and sunlight as they endure lifelong indenturement to their king. The lay public is in awe of the organist and his apparent mastery over the king of instruments. They fear and respect him, and he has little difficulty extracting small sums and favors from them. Yet in truth, the organist does not master the organ, but it is the organ that controls the organist. His arms flailing, his little legs pumping. He is a marionette, obedient to his master. Alongside the organ and its captive servant stands the choir, with its God-given musical relationship of one man, one voice. In comparison to the choir, the organ is far bigger, louder, in every way demonstrating its superiority, threatening to drown the human voice with its inanimate bombast. Regiments of pipes expropriating the ether threaten to suck the very breath from the unaided voices of human beings. Although the pipes speak with the same air as we do, the organ need never breathe. Rather, it sustains a continuous inhalation, incessant, voluminous, all the while ready to blast a volcanic litany. This tyrant king has insinuated itself into the apse, audaciously anticipating the unseating of God himself. Outside the house of God, the secular unbeliever seeks after fleeting pleasures in pastimes accompanied by the mellifluous sound of the theater organ. Matinee goers crowd into the darkness of cavernous movie palaces to gape at a silvery screen and escape into the solace of foolish dreams. While he neglects his daily duties, the cinema goer sits couched in a lush bed of swelling chords, lulling him into a state of drowsy submission. When the theater organ is not drugging the listener into a life-sapping slumber, it parades a cavalcade of klaxon horns, whistles, noisemakers, and indignities of all varieties. But behind its gay painted face lurks the self-same demon. In fact, organs have invaded all centers of our civic life, from baseball parks, skating rinks, even nationally broadcast television game shows. Today, sophisticated electronics have made possible a previously unimaginable proposition: an organ in every home. The modest expense of these electronic organs allows for its rapid spread. However, the full harmful effect of these new electronic instruments is not yet known. Can mankind reclaim his birthright as the sole channel of God's greatest gift? Some heroic individuals have taken matters into their own hands, often against strong opposition, and even against the law of the land. Throughout history, men of destiny have challenged the rule of this tyrant king by destroying organs and houses of worship, though even the Puritan Lord Protector married his daughters to the music of an organ in his own home. In more recent times, daring property developers and their accountants have made significant strides against this menace. Some modern composers have steadfastly refused to write music for the pipe organ, or have attempted to jam the organ with problematic avant-garde devices. But there are those who work tirelessly to ensure...
This is Jennifer Lawrence from Old Chatham, and you are listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
Tune in to live programming Saturday, February 8th on WGXC 90.7 FM. At 3 p.m., we air the latest town hall meeting from Representative Antonio Delgado, this one from the Hyde Park Town Hall in Dutchess County. That's at 3 p.m. on 90.7 FM. At 7 p.m., we go to Vermont to Epsilon Spires, where Catskills' Ross Goldstein plays the mellotron with Catskills' Brian Dewan on the pipe organ. Then at 8:30, we go live to the Avalon Lounge in Catskill, where Bobby Previtt performs. He's later followed by the Disappointer Sisters DJs that spin records late into the night. Tune in Saturday, February 8th, to live programming from your community on your community radio station, 90.7 FM WGXC.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Hilo Catskill, cafe, bar, art gallery, and performance space located at 365 Main Street, Catskill, New York. Waveform's WGXC is pleased to broadcast live from Hilo every Tuesday morning starting at 9 a.m. In addition, Hilo live events are streamed and broadcast in conjunction with the Waveform Radio Transmit Partner Program.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elaine Shimono of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Like a fire hydrant, like a public drinking fountain, like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
Primaries and caucuses so white. The Iowa fiasco is the death knell of a failed 50-year experiment. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The Iowa caucuses are monumentally important in the selection of presidential candidates in the United States. The question we have to ask is, why? As this goes to press, only partial results have been released so far by the Iowa Democratic Party. Most blame falls on the party and a software company called Shadow, which made the disastrous app that failed to provide the promised instantaneous caucus results, then the party's backup system, a tried-and-true phone bank that served the caucus process for half a century, proved to be insufficient for the volume of precincts desperately trying to call in their results. Technical snafus notwithstanding, the fundamental question is why two almost entirely white states, Iowa, along with New Hampshire, with its first-in-the-nation primary status, are allowed to have such a disproportionate influence over who the two major parties nominate for president. The Democracy Now! NewsHour sparked the most recent incarnation of this debate during the Presidential Forum on Environmental Justice we co-hosted, held last November at South Carolina State University, an HBCU, a historically black college or university, in Orangeburg, South Carolina. This is the exchange that was the first time a major 2020 Democratic presidential candidate, in this case Elizabeth Warren, was asked to comment on the nomination process's racial disparity.
Senator Warren, just 30 seconds left. But speaking about racial injustice, do you think the order of the primary state should change? You have Iowa and New Hampshire.
Let me just, before you finish, are you actually going to ask me to sit here and criticize Iowa and New Hampshire?
No, I'm asking about the order.
No, that is what Iowa
but,
and New Hampshire
but let me
are
just
all about.
Ask, they're two of the whitest states in the country. And then we moved to South Carolina with a very significant population of people of color. And it means the candidates spend so much of their time catering to those first two states. Overall, do you think that should change?
Look, I'm just a player in the game on this one.
Senator Warren was visibly irritated by the question as she left the stage. Later, MSNBC played our exchange with Warren for then Democratic presidential hopeful Julian Castro.
Our country has changed a lot in those 50 years.
demographically, it's not reflective of the United States as a whole, certainly not reflective of the Democratic Party.
Castro replied, who is now a surrogate for Senator Warren.
I don't believe that forever we should be married to Iowa and New Hampshire going first.
Gilberto Hinojosa, the chair of the Texas Democratic Party, appeared on Democracy Now! Not long after Warren's dismissal of the issue.
Texas is the second largest state in the country. It is probably the most diverse state in the country. 40% of the population in the state is Hispanic. 15% is either African American or Asian American. We are a majority minority state, as is California and New Mexico. I'm from the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. There's about 1.4 million people that live in the Rio Grande Valley. It's about 90% Latino. It's like if we would have our primary in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas and make and have candidates spending 3 months there continuously going to barbecues and different events that were being sponsored by the local elected officials. Nobody would think that that would be representative.
What would be representative? According to the Pew Research Center, the Democratic Party is now more than 40% non-white. Compare that with Iowa, which is more than 90% white, and New Hampshire at 93% white. This according to the U.S. Census as of 2018. One can anecdotally verify these numbers by viewing video of just about any campaign event in either state as the camera pans across a sea of white faces. Pew also notes that post-millennials, those born between 1997 and 2012, will be the most racially diverse generation in U.S. history. According to figures recently released by the U.S. Census, while Iowa's population increased marginally, the state actually lost residents under 18. New Hampshire's decline in young people was even more pronounced. Clearly, as these two states become older and whiter, they become decreasingly representative of the Democratic Party. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Art Cullen, editor of the Storm Lake Times in Iowa, wrote this week, "Iowa's function in the nomination process is to responsibly winnow the field." He adds, "Nobody has any clue who will win our two-year-long parlor game," unquote. Choosing the nominee to challenge the impeached yet acquitted incumbent President Donald Trump is no game. There's strength in diversity. It's time for the Democratic Party to abandon its failed 50-year experiment with the first-in-the-nation caucus and primary in Iowa and New Hampshire. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
We are now joined by Hudson Common Council President Tom DiPietro, who's going to preview what's going on at next week's Hudson Common Council meeting. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me on again. This Monday is our informal meeting. As you know, every month there's first a formal meeting where there's more open discussion, and then we have the formal meeting on the following Tuesday where we actually vote on things to get them through. So this Monday at 7 p.m., actually, let me change that. At 6 p.m., we're going to have some hearings on two proposed laws. One is a moratorium on short-term rentals, a six-month moratorium that allows us to craft a comprehensive and fair short-term housing regulation. And then the second hearing is about modifying the existing law about how the lodging tax is allocated. As it currently exists, a large percentage of the lodging tax goes to a tourism board automatically and by statute. But we're trying to change that so that it goes to the general fund, and then the tourism board itself will petition the council when it wants to spend money. We'll get to do it that way.
And so will this defund the tourism board?
Yes. Now, the tourism board, interestingly enough, at the regular meeting afterwards at 7, where the council gets four appointees, and we're going to submit our four this Monday. So we have our four recommendations, and I'm happy to say all four of them are women, and one of them is my co-host on the Thursday afternoon show, Selah Graham or CC Graham. So it should be interesting. We're also making our final appointments to the I shouldn't say a final, another appointment to the Conservation Advisory Committee and the Hudson Industrial Development Agency. So we're filling up all the boards that the council gets to appoint. And I have to say, our latest appointment to the Conservation Advisory Council is a very talented young man named Tom O'Dowd, who has quite an interest and background in environmental issues. So that's really great. When you can find somebody who wants to volunteer, who actually has some kind of expertise in the subject that is, you know, the subject of the board. So that's great. Also, let's see. Oh, we're going to, in a slightly more controversial decision, I know my fellow programmer, I should admit that I am also a WGXC programmer, my fellow programmer, Dan Stewart, is not happy with an effort to raise the meter price on Warren Street. What we're doing is only on Warren Street are we changing the meters from 25 cents an hour to 25 cents for a half hour. This is a little bit of a revenue raiser, but not that much. But more importantly, it incentivizes people to park off of Warren. We're trying to keep the flow on Warren moving because, you know, there are people who just feed meters all day, and that's not good for anyone. It's not good for businesses. It's not good for anybody who, you know, who needs to shop shortly. You know, I mean, there's very little reason to park on Warren Street for 2 hours or more, unless you're working there, and then you should be not parking there.
So you just want more given flow on Warren Street, more cars right. Moving in and out.
Right, and there's plenty of parking behind Warren Street, just a half a block behind it. There's these lots that are just empty often during the day, and they will be cheaper. So, you know, if you want to park for longer and pay less, park off Warren Street, or even off of Warren Street where there are meters, you can still get, you know, the older rate. And this doesn't cost much to change. And to answer some people who, when we first suggested this, were worried that we had to buy new meters now. It's a simple change. It involves a handheld device that you go from meter to meter, and it changes the metric.
And this is not you haven't done this yet. There is still a chance for people to come out and give their opinion on this at the meeting Monday?
Sure. Next Monday. We'd like to hear from you. I'm sure there are people who won't be too happy with it, but, you know, it's such a minor increase, and I don't see why anybody would be opposed to incentivizing parking off of Warren Street. You know, because Warren Street, you know, with the double parking that sometimes goes on, and it's just a clogged mess sometimes. And I think this will help solve some of that in a small way. You know, it's not a major change. And really, you know, our parking meter prices are incredibly low.
So
you have to go to other municipalities, and it's nothing like this.
So you're hoping there'll be some room for those UPS trucks to...
Exactly, because those, you know, everybody... The one double parkers we don't really want to complain about are the delivery trucks that making local deliveries, because they, you know, those are hardworking people who have to do their job.
It actually makes it more dangerous for them if they're double parked, because they're out in the street.
True. That's true, because if they go out the street side, they're at risk.
So if there are more parking spaces for those people, it makes it safer for them. It makes it safer for car traffic, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just flowing. Yeah,
I hope so. When I drive down Warren Street, I'm amazed how many times I have to drive around a vehicle. And that's always, as you point out, a risk. There's always, you know, you've got to be really cautious when you do that.
But maybe we'll get Dan Seward on to give the other side of the story.
Yeah, well, he's worried because, you know, people go to John Doe and they want to hang out for, you know, 5 hours. Because, you know how record collectors are.
Well, there's so much to see in that space.
And there's so much to see. Right. Dan, don't get on my case.
Any other issues coming up Monday, February 10th at 6 p.m. The public hearing starts, and 7 p.m. the meeting starts.
Right, and I'm sure at the hearings there'll be plenty of people who want to come out because, you know, the short-term rental regulation has always been controversial, and I'm amazed that people are object to a moratorium because we're just buying some time to craft a fair and equitable regulation. There are always inevitably going to be people who are unhappy with it, but that's how it falls. That's just the nature of the beast. But we hope people come out and talk about it. And secondly, I really don't see why anyone would be opposed to us figuring out how to deal with the tourism money in a better way. I mean, the idea of allocating by statute money has to go into a fund for tourism marketing is just bad policy. And I want to remind people, it doesn't mean that the tourism board is going to be erased. It just means that when they want to spend money, they have to come to the council like anyone else, like any other board or any other, project.
So instead of the whims of the economy determining their budget, it'll be the whims of the common council members.
That's one way of putting it. But yeah, it will be the whims. I mean, I think this round, the first year was controversial. They were finding their legs. They made some mistakes. The law itself was poorly crafted by saying, this money not only went to a tourism board, but had to be used for marketing the city. That was that really restricted a lot of the process. So now we're just, it's not so much that everything, they still had to go before the council, even with the money automatically allocated. And it was at the council where they met resistance. I mean, suddenly out of the blue, because their meetings were not really, there wasn't a lot of public input or public disclosure along the way. When they came to the council with this request for using $80,000 of their money to hire a marketing firm from Tennessee, people on the council were kind of dismayed, to say the least. So I think this time around, we're going to start fresh. And there is at least one member who was on the previous board to provide a little continuity. But I think they're going to re-envision how that board works. Hopefully. We hope.
And the tourism board is – I'm trying to find it online. It's not part of the City of Hudson website. It's a whole different entity?
It's a creation. It was created by the law that started the lodging tax. That was part as when the law was crafted, it included the tourism board. Now, I hope they'll put if it's not on the website, I hope that'll change. The chair by statute was defined as the chair of the Economic Development Committee. And this year that's Calvin Lewis. So Calvin, I think, even said to the paper, it's a question of, trying to reimagine how we define the whole process. But I hope it'll be part of, it should be on the website the way everything else has been. I know the DRI committee now has made their process much more open on the website than it has been in the past.
Yeah, I'm not seeing when they have their regular meetings on the meetings don't seem to be on the City of Hudson website.
Because they haven't met yet.
Until we get
these appointments that I mentioned
settled,
there won't be a first meeting. But Calvin is going to consult with all the new members, come up with a night, and they'll have a regular meeting.
Oh, great. Okay, any other issues this coming Monday?
There's always issues, Tom. We're always talking about housing, and I hope we can make some progress soon. A lot of meetings, I guess the big development on the housing front is that, there's been so many different agencies and groups working towards increasing the housing, the amount of housing in Hudson. And I think we're finally bringing them all together. And that's the key, because if one group or one element in the process is opposed to what you're doing, that can scuttle everything. So in the future, if we're all working together, I think we'll actually start breaking ground for new housing. And I'm not just talking about affordable housing, which is definitely part of it, but all levels of affordability. Remember, affordable housing can be anything from completely subsidized to 80% of market rate, but also some market rate housing, because market rate housing, eases up the market in general. Because right now it's what's available out there is at the higher end And even those are threatened by the short-term rental market.
And that seems to be normal market forces would generally create higher-end housing, yeah, because the people creating it have more incentive because they can make more money on higher-end.
They can make more money. And, you know, I'm not a... Not to apologize for the developers, but they've also invested in the usually the renovation. I'll tell you the one difference between a renovator who's looking to rent as opposed to short-term rental. Short-term rental developers often only renovate the internal part of the insides of their buildings. Someone who's looking to rent their house or building often does a more complete renovation. So that's, you know, one thing in their favor. On the other hand, you're right. It does drive up the price.
So are you talking specifically about a particular housing issue this week or just
no.
It's an ongoing?
No, it's not. Oh, we do have two resolutions, in fact, related to housing. One is a resolution to do a vacancy rate study. Now, the key to this, I don't know if you followed the new housing rules that the state passed, rental rules, protections that were passed last year. But one of them is allows every municipality to decide for itself whether it wants rent control. Now, the key to rent control is you have to prove or demonstrate that there is a 5% or less vacancy rate. So at first I thought that meant in the entire city, but it doesn't. It means only in the buildings that would qualify for rent control. And those buildings are buildings that have six or more units and were built before 1974.
So Hudson doesn't have a lot of those places, but there are some, right?
There are some. And someone the other night, an activist from Kingston, said that when they looked at this, they actually identified 300 units. Now, that seems incredible to me, but it might be true. So we'll find out.
They identified 300 in Hudson or in Kingston?
In Hudson.
In Hudson.
Yeah. No, it's a housing activist from Kingston.
All right.
So if that proves true, that's significant. And maybe rent control or rent stabilization is in our future. I'm open to the idea. I don't, you know, we got to see how this plays out.
So you're just starting the conversation about this issue, because I haven't seen any other upstate city go this route with this new regulation.
Yeah, well, it's a tough haul because, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, the real estate interests certainly don't want rent control. So, you know, if it goes forward, we're going to see a lot of opposition, and it'll be interesting to see how it falls out. You know, some people say rent control can kill a community, but, you know, that's debatable.
All right. Any other issues this week?
And then finally, another on the resolution on the housing front is to insist that we – I mean, I don't know how binding this resolution is, but the corner at 4th and State, the northwest corner, is an empty lot owned by the city.
It's kind of a very sloped empty lot, right?
Well, the sloped one is not. That's owned by the Galvin Foundation.
Ah.
The one on the northwest side of that corner is currently used for parking, but that's owned by the city. And the resolution calls on the city to make sure they use it for housing.
For housing, so you would build some sort of structure there.
Yeah, something. Because you know there are limited lots available for housing in the city, so we got to be very careful how we develop them.
All right, and anything else at the meeting itself, resolution wise or issue wise?
No, I think that covers most of it. People are always welcome, both at the hearings, of course, and then at the meeting at 6 for the hearing, 7 for the meeting, Monday, what's that, the 10th?
February 10th, yes.
February 10th.
And then quickly, the other meetings, I see a couple cancellations. It looks like the DRI meeting on the 12th is canceled and the Historic Preservation meeting on the 14th is canceled.
I got to tell you, Tom, I don't really get too involved with historic preservation because those meetings are on a Friday morning. And despite the fact that I'm talking with you now, I'm usually out and about doing some things on a Friday morning. But I don't know why it was canceled, to tell you the truth. I think they were meeting today.
Yeah, it's next week is the one that's canceled, the 14th.
Oh, I see. They just changed
according to the website.
And yeah, they have. Go ahead.
And the DRI meeting is canceled on the 12th, too?
It It was canceled, but it was moved to another date in the month. That's always just they're always, the DRI in particular, are tentative dates because we never know exactly what's on the plate, you know, to deal with.
I see. It's been moved to the 18th at 2:30 p.m.
Oh, yes. There you go. Because I think we're waiting for some information so that we can act on it. The DRI is always, I think, listed as tentative because, we move it around. There's a lot of people involved, and it's a daytime meeting. And daytime meetings, are subject more to the whims of people's schedules than evening meetings.
Let's see. And then on the 11th, Tuesday the 11th, there's a tentative IDA meeting at 1 p.m. There's a tentative planning board meeting at 6 p.m. And then
those all look like they'll happen, yes.
Wednesday there's a Hudson Housing Authority meeting at 6 p.m.
That's happening.
And at Thursday at 2 p.m., there's an HCDPA meeting at 2 p.m., Thursday the
13th. Yeah, I can't wait till that gets started again. That's been a little dormant near the end of last year for a number of reasons. But I think it's a well-positioned agency. It's a city agency.
What does it stand for?
Hudson Community Development and Planning Agency, or Hudson City
Development and Planning Agency, yeah, but it's development and planning. Is there anything special going on at any of those meetings next week?
Not that I know of. I think they're just this is their kickoff meetings for the year because, there are a lot of appointments that have to be made. So it should be interesting. All those meetings should be worth attending.
All right. Anything else news in the city of Hudson this week?
Not that I know of. I did mention in a totally different vein in my WGXC persona as a Thursday programmer, I forgot to mention that my friend John McCullough, the owner of the Half Moon, has two shows, and you can check them out on Instagram, not at the Half Moon, but elsewhere throughout the county on the other side of the river, where he's doing, John, believe it or not, has is quite the reggae ska DJ, and I think he has a show in Kingston and a show at Scribner's this weekend or this week. So if you can check out both those sites, give a look to John McCullough's DJ skills.
All right.
Little plug for John, that's all. I meant to do it yesterday and I forgot.
All right, this has been Hudson Common Council President Tom DiPietro with this week's preview of the February 10th Hudson Common Council meeting.
Okay, Tom, thanks a lot. Always a pleasure.
All right, thanks for calling in.
We're here today because the New York State Comptroller keeps $13 billion in Exxon and other fossil fuel companies. And that contributes to the destruction of life on the planet. It contributes to the wildfires, the extreme weather, and the droughts. And it's wrong for the state to seek to profit from the destruction of life, but it's also a very bad financial investment. In fact, the state has lost $12 billion by not divesting. It is time for Tom DiNapoli to divest. We need all our financial institutions, the state controller, banks, insurance companies, to immediately stop putting money into fossil fuels, which is driving climate change.
My name's Connor Armbruster, and I'm here on behalf of my 9-month-old daughter, who is already inheriting a world that's vastly different from ours and the world of our parents. And it is a disaster, and it's terrifying, and that's why I'm here. We are in the City of Albany Comptroller's office, and we have blocked the entrance. And I'm with Extinction Rebellion.
My name's Rebecca. I'm a graduate student, but more than that, I'm a human being. And when I think about the climate crisis, when I think about what climate change is doing to the planet and to communities all over the world, this is the most important place for me to be right now. And doing everything that I can with my whole body to fight against the destruction of the planet.
I'm Jenna Karmoski. I'm a rebel of Extinction